All right, welcome everyone. My name is Dan Cantlin. I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation for Cure Violence. And just to start out, Cure Violence is formerly Ceasefire Chicago. It's kind of a rebranding, kind of just shows a progression of our organization, to focus more on the health aspect, which is appropriate for a public health conference. So we are still known as Ceasefire Chicago in Chicago, though, because we've been there for 10 years. So I just wanted to point that out so as not to confuse everyone, especially if I go back and forth. And we have a couple other people here for the presentation. Ulysses Floyd, who's a supervisor from our South Chicago program site, and Shango Johnson. He's a community health worker from Englewood. And then we have Jason Featherstone, too, who he is my program manager of our England site. And he has a presentation on Wednesday, just a little plug for him, if you want to find out how it works in England. So, real quickly, since there's not a lot of time, if I'm not able to get to something, you'll know what I missed, possibly. I'm going to talk about the problem of urban neighborhood violence, what a typical Cure Violence site looks like, theoretical model, just a little bit, really just touch on that. We could spend an hour, all of us, on our theoretical models. And then raising the bar and unpacking the black box of building the evidence base. I think having a logic model presentation right before is really going to help. So I'll make references to that. And then measurement development of this measure that we have in terms of attitude and behavior change and how we're using it, next steps. So now this is a map of average homicide rates, or a graph of average homicide rates from like 1991 to 2010. Per 100,000. So the first thing that needs to be acknowledged when we talk about violence is that it's gone down tremendously, really, right? We don't often acknowledge that. I think people are starting to in the research community. But, you know, since the late 80s, probably up to 93, it's gone down substantially. It's kind of leveled off recently. As you can see, New York City's right around the national U.S. I think it's a little bit below. Chicago's well above both of those. And then we have where we work. The 11th District is one area where we work, you know, where the rates are just off the charts. And so I wanted to show this because this is kind of like, this is where Cure Violence can operate. If you look at the UCR data, you can see that like the top 15 cities drive a quarter of the homicides. You know, we know, and they're usually the same cities year after year, right? Detroit, Gary, Chicago. Chicago had over 500 last year. We had the largest number. We didn't have the largest rate just because of the size of the city. But so we know what cities are driving kind of the national numbers. And then even within the cities, we know what the neighborhoods are. You know, in Chicago, we say the South and West sides, but we also know where in the South and West side. So when it comes down to it, you have a small number of communities, for instance, driving Chicago numbers. Chicago and like cities drive national numbers. You know, we know where they're located, and that's what Cure Violence was kind of developed by Gary Slutkin to address, kind of looking at it as a contagious disease, as an epidemic. So before going into theory, I like to get very concrete, like what does it look like? In Chicago, we're talking relatively small areas, 2 to 3 police beats, can be around 20,000 people, so relatively small for an urban area. We use crime data to select our community, census, some neighborhood capacity. And then in terms of staffing, we usually contract through a community-based organization. We have 3 to 4 outreach workers. I'll go more into that. 2 to 3 violence interrupters is kind of our direct line staff, a program manager, and a supervisor. Our outreach workers are like kind of case managers, but not your typical case managers. A lot of them are, you know, the goal is they need to be from the neighborhood and credible. So we value experiential learning more than academic credentials. So in other words, they were largely part of the life, whether that's drugs, gangs, prison, etc. Same is true for the violence interrupters, even more so in terms of having a record and being from the neighborhood. And just real quickly, Chicago, we have 12 to 18 sites. We're across the nation. We're about an 8 to 10 in New York City or New York State, New Orleans, Baltimore, Kansas City. Again, just to highlight, they were talking relatively small areas. In Englewood, we're only in 3 beats out of 15. So this shows area and population. We're only in 20%, you know, 21 to 22% of this one neighborhood in Chicago. And I just like to point that out because everyone thinks here at Cure Violence, oh, you guys been in Chicago forever. And true, at least since 2000, but we're like in the southwest corner of a very violent community, three beats, which is hard because you have violence all around you. Right? And so you can't really, you don't stay in those administrative boundaries, and there's only so much you could do. And then we have some pretty good stats, 2012 versus 2011, although kind of cheating because homicides were off the charts in 2011 in Englewood. I think they jumped by like 20 or 25 that year. Quickly, very quickly, and people can follow up with me later, kind of the Cure Violence model. As I was talking, it's an epidemic control model. I'm listening to Gary Slutkin, our developer, earlier talk, and he just said, you know, you go directly at it. I think that was the best way to describe it. Go directly at it as if it's cholera, AIDS, the flu. Go to the source, right? Most violence prevention programs, they don't go to the source. You know, it's usually a community coalition of the same players. People talk about jobs, this and that. We target the shooters and the shot callers. We don't target just gang members. We target those with influence within the gang. You know, one of our criteria is, has been shot in the last 90 days, not just been shot. So I like to really highlight that we work with the highest to high risk, a population really that's largely outside of every social service organization. I mean, they're involved in the criminal justice system. That's about it. Everyone else has kind of given up or they've kind of cycled through it. So in terms of epidemic control, what do? Do you detect, you interrupt, change behavior among highest risk, change community norms? And then I just filled in some of the things that's on our implementation checklist. So in terms of, we talked about how we identify the neighborhood, we look at 3 to 5 years of data. Once the site gets going, we have an extensive game planning process where we map everything on these really large maps, including shootings, killings, mediations, clients, gangs, groups, cliques. Go block by block, literally, to understand the dynamics. Change behavior among highest risk. That involves conflict mediation. If anyone has seen The Interrupters, that's a documentary about our program that talks a little bit about it. But we have this position, Violence Interrupters, and their job is to prevent conflict and then to address it when it happens. That's it. They don't have clients. So they're kind of like the old, I like to say, they're like the old mythical beat cop. Because I don't know if they ever existed, but they walk around the neighborhood, get to know everyone. They're already known before they start because they're from the neighborhood, and they already know people. But that's their job, is just get to know the gossip, the rumors, and when things are going to kick off. And then we have, our outreach workers work with clients. So we collect some basic things, in-person contacts, hours, how long they've been with them, group-level work. We've been focusing more on groups recently. So we bring people in from either the same gang or different gangs and work in a group called community workshops. I'm kind of stepping up our work from like that individual one-to-one with the outreach workers to group level. And then hopefully soon, you know, focus more on the community as well in terms of, you know, connection to service providers. We're really stepping up on public education campaign. We have about 400 surveys recently conducted because we're going to roll out a new campaign. So that'll be interesting to see. So I'm just going to move on for that before I get stuck. Research and raising the bar. I'm an internal evaluator for Cure Violence. To date, we've had 3 outside evaluations, independent and objective evaluations, a DOJ in 2008 Chicago, a CDC-sponsored one for Baltimore, and recently a Center for Court Innovation, which involves New York. And they've all had positive results, not unequivocal, but largely, especially for a community-based program, very strong results, and that's kind of led to further dissemination of our model. But as an internal evaluator, and just as a type of evaluator I am, what I'm more interested in how it works. You know, we're going to build the evidence base. That's what we want to do. You know, it's hard to do RCTs. Hopefully we're going to have another, you know, match QED coming up. So that's kind of like a given, right? But I really want to use data to inform practice, programming, and policy. And then how does it work? And that gets to the logic modeling, right, that we just talked about. It's kind of that invisible black box. We think we hit all these things, and that ends up in the change. But is it true? So real quickly, because I'm talking about behavior change, but I want to highlight our conflict mediations, because a lot of people know about that. And just because that kind of spans our whole model there, as you can see. So what do we mean with conflict mediations? These are incidents that happen on the street. Location of conflict, 57% are on the street. Our outreach usually finds out through personal contact and daily canvassing. And just want to bring attention real quickly and move on. So cause of conflict, 40% personal altercation, 35% gang. This is data from our staff, okay? This isn't official data. But that's interesting because I hear it's probably like 90 to 95% in Chicago, according to official data. And then some of the things that we found that's been helpful in having successful mediations are using some of the strategies that we developed and operationalized, formal mediation processes. And then there's kind of the obvious, which isn't so obvious when you find significant findings, right? But if it's gang, it was harder to mediate to success. The more violence, it was harder. And if there was a weapon, it was harder. One interesting thing came out of this study, and I'm writing this up for a paper right now, weapons were brought to 41% of the mediations. So this is kind of like what's real and what's not real as you're talking about. We train that, you know, you shouldn't do mediations with weapons ever. So the black intervention box, which components are driving results? And I'm focused on the behavior change here. And I'm going to quickly go through some slides because I'm probably already well over where I should be. And these are slides that I went out and I trained all our sites, and then we did group trainings. And, you know, is cure violence making a difference? We look at a lot of things, number of clients, contact hours, and then outcomes. So I'd show here's neighborhood A, look at that, crime goes down. Look at that, nice and linear. Now here is the number of ceasefire staff. Okay, well, it's because of ceasefire or cure violence. Well, here's the number of police. All our neighborhoods have special police initiatives because we're kind of the worst neighborhoods. And then I always throw in a ridiculous one, like the number of urban farms goes up at the same amount as well. Just to kind of make a point and saying that is not enough. And this is one thing we could do. Again, you know, it's not an RCT, but build the evidence base. And the purple down there, OW assess, that's our outreach worker assessment. That's the behavior change measure, right? We say we change mindset and behaviors. That's why the community goes down. But we're just looking at, like, inputs to community outcomes. So at least this builds evidence. If we're working with the highest to high risk and we're working with an adequate number and you see parallel decreases, you have a better argument. So when I first came on board, I heard a lot of this, oh, we change mindsets, Dan. We change people's mindsets. And I'd be like, what the heck does that really mean? And it's, you know, thinking, attitude. And when I say behavior change, it's about a lot more than behavior. It's readiness for change, capacity for change, stages of change. So development of our measure, basically, I think I could have developed it after four focus groups with our staff. Because they do this every day. They gauge where a person's at, they work on them with certain things. But of course, I went to the literature, and a lot of the items come from literature, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous, exercise, smoking cessation. One of our mantras is that violence is learned. And I've always believed that, but I'm like, but. You know, I believe, oh, yeah, but. But when you learn about, like, behavior change, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, it helped me buy into our program more. It doesn't matter whether you really buy into that or not, because to change the behavior, you need to do the same things you do across a lot of behaviors. And so that was rather illuminating. And, it, you know, the measure obviously going to be real-life knowledge. Specific concrete is easy to use, helpful in real time. And so these are just some examples. And so, again, these are informed through the literature but adapted for violence. So it's definitely a unique measure. CF message, most violence starts out as small and petty conflicts. That's one of our program mantras. And we kind of go with the belief that if you're not buying into some basic program precepts, you're not going to be changing your behavior. You know, and one of them is that you have the ability to change your behavior. So we ask about that. And then, of course, we have, you know, stages of change, self-efficacy, and then, you know, challenges. You could be ready, willing, and able, but if you have a serious cocaine problem and you always get violent when you use cocaine, it's not going to work for you, right? And so here's another graph that I use to try to just get some buy-in at the sites of how this can be directly applicable to their work. And this is, so my participant, You got four time points. We do it every 3 months. And this is stimulus control. But, you know, that sounds great when I'm here at a conference, but it's avoidance. It's avoidance of people, places, things. They teach it to you in 12-step programs. They teach it to you in smoking, everything, right? My participant tries to avoid people who put him or her in high-risk situations. Tries to remove him or her from high-risk situations. It's the first thing our workers work on them with, right? If you're not there, it can't happen. If you're hanging out on the block, stuff is going to go down. Remove yourself from it, okay? And now I'm just going to quickly go through some of the measure. We have a ruler measure right at the beginning, and this is kind of what every staff member thinks. Currently, where is this person at in terms of believing violence is an acceptable way to handle conflict? From never to always. And then, somewhat more typical, because again, the caseworkers are filling it out on the client, how much would they agree? And we start with ceasefire messages. And so that would be that most violence starts out as small and petty conflicts. And then we go, has the skills to de-escalate a situation that could lead to violence, right? So efficacy, tries to surround himself with positive friends and family. Kind of another basic adaptive social network. It's kind of right after stimulus control. Probably the least concrete we get, we do have the construct of hope. Has a positive outlook on life. A lot of the literature says how important hope is. But we don't get too far down that road. And then we ask about challenges. And I quickly, you know, if you have a substance abuse problem, mental health problem. Again, you know, they're not doctors. You know, everyone was hesitant. Well, Dan, how can I know? You know, but, well, is he drunk every time you see him? then he has an alcohol problem. You can feel confident about putting down that that's a challenge to his change, right? And having a decent job. Okay. One of the things I quickly wanted to highlight and finish up. So when we have this, everyone has a binder that they get, like informed consent, like all that. This nice binder of training materials. And also like 2 pages of graphs that I have them fill out each time they do it, which they just started. We're on time point 2. So it's very old school, but I think it's going to be very effective because it's just right there. And so everyone fills out where their client is in terms of violence and then the level of effort. Those are the 2 ruler measures that everyone will do. And then I just say, you know, you pick up like 4 to 6 of whatever you want. It's like an individualized treatment plan. Because our database isn't all that great. It's about jobs and long-term, like, you know, intermediate to long-term, as we're talking about in the logic model. Getting a full-time job. If you have 2 violent felonies and you're smoking weed every day and hanging out on the corner, getting a full-time job is far away. Okay? And so this measure really helps fill a gap. Because 90% of what our workers do, we're not capturing. You know? Has a high school degree or GED. They're either going to do it or not. We need to, better at capturing what exactly behavior change is, which is a very simple concept, but it's very, very difficult to do day to day and very difficult to monitor. So that's how we're doing that. So each one kind of creates their own treatment plan. And then we feel that this is going to help be really helpful in supervision. Because as a case manager, I know I've never really had a good supervisor outside of if they supported me. Because if they'd ask me about so-and-so, I'd be like, I think of maybe the last 2 weeks. How's Dan doing? Okay, Dan, he's been really bad lately. So at least now we have like up to a year's worth following this client and conversations can be more specific. And our workers are also kind of high risk themselves. A lot of them, it's their first job, you know, and supervision is difficult. They carry up to 15 clients. How do you keep these things straight? Because this is a matter of life and death, you know, with the people they're working with. I mean, someone even got killed just last night. So it's very important, and that's what I want all our data to be useful for the program, as well as, you know, to give us the information we need. And so once we get enough, because it's a 7-page measure, going to do some confirmatory factor analyses, can really do some implementation analyses and growth curve modeling, among other things. So, but like I said, great for supervision and probably will help standardize and improve practice more than anything because they got, you know, every month they're filling this out and it's reminders of what they should be working on with each client.